Michael Barrizo, decedent, created a trust in 1996 when he was married to his first wife, Aileen. The decedent Michael and his first wife had an adult disabled daughter. Her care was also funded by a separate S&T and governmental assistance. I think this decision was interesting because when we're thinking about funding and this blended family, I think Clyde talks a lot about this at the conferences about the value of a separate S&T. And this decision highlights that. There was litigation about the RLT or the Revocable Living Trust, but because Esperanza had her own separately funded S&T, that never became part of this litigation. It was only about the underlying revocable trust that Mr. Barrizo had created. So value and points to Clyde. I don't know where you are, but point to Clyde. After his first wife's passing in June of 2012, the decedent married his second wife, Patricia. Between March 2014 to November 30th, 2014, decedent retained attorneys to update his trust to name his second wife, but unfortunately did not complete the amendment prior to his death. Patricia filed a miscellany of legal arguments as to why she had an interest in decedent's estate, including the trust estate, including that she was a beneficiary, allegating constructive trust, alleging constructive trust, and promissory estoppel. The court found none of her arguments availing and upheld attorney's fees against her in excess of $500,000. Again, 5 points to Clyde. Then there's a separate S&T that the disabled daughter wasn't involved in. But I think what I take away from this signature is the value of signing. And I think in our agreements, you know, maybe we put in our engagement letter, hey, there are instances where you may not execute. You have a blended family. Please be mindful that our target is this time. And things like this we're seeing happening, I mean, prior to COVID, but certainly now during the pandemic, where people are just are coming to us but not executing. And so that value in something like this, if we fast forward to today, is quite high, and as high as $500,000. So our next decision, Borg versus Warren. Caveat emptor? You know, one of the things when people come to us talking about trust or special needs trust is that, isn't it, Bryn, you keep me together today. Okay. doesn't a trust have like special powers? Right? I mean, if we're just like slighted by someone that we could bring RICO charges against, shouldn't it just invalidate just bad acts? So I take away from this decision some caveat emptor. It still applies. So in this decision, there was a criminal scheme involving several single member shell companies that defrauded customers who were attempting to purchase trained dogs. Charles Warren and Jacob M. Duddick Warren formed entities for various ostensible purposes, including real estate transactions, farm rentals, and much more. Included among Warren and Duddick's schemes was a diabetic alert dog program. Isn't that like a shame? Like, where they would provide customers with specially trained service dogs that would alert when the dogs detected altered blood sugar levels. And so in this decision, among the program's unwitting customers was the Rich family, who had an autistic child. Though the company was collapsing, Warren and Duddick promised Rich that she would receive her dog in record time. Many of the dogs weren't received. Many of them weren't trained well. And the court found in this particular decision that the plaintiffs had complicated their case by pledging numerous causes of action that were conflicting and didn't make sense. And the court just said it's as simple as they didn't get the benefit of the bargain that they struck. There's no dog. But they alleged various things from RICO and other state law and federal claims. Ultimately, it was some of those causes of action that were conflicting, the court dismissed, but upheld it on other basis against them. So again, at the end of the day, what I take away from this is caveat emptor still applies. When we're thinking and advising clients about using the trust, we have to tell them, you're a fiduciary. It's not as just though you were a parent, right? You may have a higher duty to inquire about this. And there were some of the people purchasing these dogs that were giving very high payments. I mean, they were paying $15,000 and $20,000 out of the $25,000, right? And so this idea of as you're purchasing things with dollar values that are delayed in receipt, are you doing progress payments, right? And so when we're thinking about advising our clients or current trustees, that idea of progress payment, And verification is very important. So that's my takeaway. So the next decision we have is Cheney versus Cheney. She made a case out of that? Like, wow. Okay, so pro se obligee appeals trial court decision denying an enforcement action for child support arrears. The obligor, Stephen Mark Cheney, had been wrongfully convicted in 1987 and sentenced to life imprisonment. After the error had been established and his release in October of 2015, Stephen became entitled to compensation from the state of Texas under the Tim Cole Act. After learning of Stephen's compensation, After Stephen's ex-wife finds out that he's entitled to this compensation, she promptly files a motion for enforcement of alleged back child support. After him being wrongfully convicted and imprisoned for, I believe, 15 years? Later on in the decision, we learned, among other things, the record at the trial court showed that Stephen had satisfied his child support obligation in full. What was interesting about this decision is the requirement under the Texas Family Code that one attach the AG's pay report. So I don't know how this was even filed in the beginning. Problematic, point one. Probably two. One was the filing in the beginning. But...